can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Hey, More Than Ordinary listeners, Anne Maria here. We're kicking this week's episode off with an announcement you've all been waiting for. Making Camp, the first app from Seven Generation Games, is now available for your iPad up in the Apple App Store, and it's free. Please go there, download it, and check it out. And tell everyone you know to check it out. And we know you will, because you're amazing. We can tell by your taste in podcast. Making Camp, Apple App Store. Get it now for your iPad.
Welcome to another episode of More Than Ordinary, brought to you by Seven Generation Games. I'm Anne Marie DeMars.
I'm Marie Burns Ortiz.
And I'm Setsu Shigematsu.
And we're really lucky to have Setsu Shigematsu here today. She's an associate professor at the University of California, Riverside in the Media and Cultural Studies Department. She is the founder and brains behind the Guardian Princesses, and also very interested in feminism, sports, mixed martial arts. Just the kind of person we like, with whole kinds of interest and whole kinds of opinions. And as you know, here at More Than Ordinary, we're just brimming with opinions.
All right. So well, we figured we'd jump right in, talking about women in sports. Obviously, all of us here seem to have a connection of some sorts to sports, whether we've done them, written about them, practiced them, all of the above. So yeah, so we were talking about, you were talking about how you got involved. You were doing MMA in the early 90s and how that kind of shifted and shaped a lot of the work that you did go on to do, both professionally and on a personal level, too.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring up the topic of MMA today because I think that, you know, the question of women doing MMA, it's become much more popular now these days, and it's getting a lot more attention in the media. But for me, back in the 90s when I started doing it, I was doing it very much as a feminist practice of liberation or personal liberation practice, because, you know, I was also taught as a young girl from my mom, you know, girls, you know, don't punch and throw kicks and fight with boys and all of this thing. But I was always kind of inclined to do that. I grew up with brothers and got in quite a few scuffles with them. So as I was coming up, I still, even though I had that proclivity, because I was constantly receiving these domesticating messages, when I got to grad school and I was studying feminism from books and feminist theory and whatnot, I still felt that I was losing touch with, you know, being in my body and then translating feminist theory into that lived experience. And then there was a personal incident of sexual violence that happened to someone very, very close to me at the time that made me take a break from grad school and just train in MMA for about, you know, more than a year full time. And for me, that was something that I needed to do. So I just want to, you know, go back to that question and pose that to both of you, since both of you have had a long experience doing martial arts, doing judo, working in ESPN. What are your thoughts on women and sports and when they seem to be kind of like crossing the line into like masculine type behaviors?
Well, I think it's interesting that a lot of women I know kind of had that feminist perspective and then went into sports to express it. And I was kind of the opposite. I just wanted to do judo. I wanted to be best in the country and then best in the world. And I kept running into people telling me, you can't do that. I started sports when Title IX had not yet passed. And so it's probably odd for young people to hear that girls just weren't allowed to do a lot of things. You would go and say, I want to run track. And they would say, no, girls can't do that. And it was legal, and then you just had to go home. So in judo, I was around when it was happening, when tournaments sometimes allowed women and sometimes didn't. And my whole life, I've had people literally trying to beat me up to get me to leave, that I would go into judo and these guys would think, if I slam her enough times, she'll quit. And it's funny, we often talk on here about how the advantages that you have often grow out of your disadvantages. So because people were always trying to beat me up, literally, I got really good at arm bars, because it doesn't take that much strength to break an arm. And I would tell people that they'd kind of pound on me and bullied me, you know what? You can throw me 50 times, but how much you want to bet I won't get your arm once. And after that, people kind of held back a little bit. So for me, being a woman in a sport that's perceived as violent, I just went in because I really love judo and I had to stand up for myself. The other thing that I've seen a lot of, And, you know, I must have missed school the day they lined up all the girls and said, you have to do whatever it takes to make the boys like you. Because I just felt like if I want to do judo, I'm going to do that. If I want to run track, I'm going to do that. But I see a lot of women who make themselves less, even women who are great athletes, that they'll be at a gym and some guy will say, oh, here's how you should do it. And they'll stop and they'll listen to him. And I'll look and I'll think, who the hell is that guy? You know, you've won 5 national championships. He's Random Bob with a brown belt. But even women who are very high level in sports seem to have, I guess, maybe what you talked about, internalized some of those messages that you have to be submissive. That's one of the reasons I was so attracted to your work, your books, and The Guardian Princesses, because I think that's such an important message to send to women, you know, from the time they're little bitty. Rescue yourself. Don't wait around for Prince Charming. I mean, I'm not against Prince Charmings. You know, I've been married 3 times. Quiet, Maria. But rescue yourself. And you'd like to think that the physical endeavor of doing a sport and being great at it would have an impact. And I think it does have some impact, but maybe not enough to change all of society's messages on you have to put up with bullshit.
Well, and I think part of that comes from the media perspective as well. I mean, you look at things like tennis. And so you have, you know, some athletes, some of the top earning women's tennis players are not earning money because of how successful they're doing on the court, but it's because they're very, very attractive. You know, they're not ranked necessarily in the top 10 or they're maybe in the top 20, but, you know, they're not number one, number two. You know, you have some players that are, but then there's some players, like I said, that aren't. And I think that sends a big message. There was something going on surfing and about the woman, the best woman surfer in the world, one of the best women surfers in the world, has a really, really hard time getting endorsements because she's not this, you know, 5'10" blonde supermodel looking type. And I think that that sends a message that even if you're really, really good at something, unless you're really, really good and attractive, you're probably not going to do as well as other people, or specifically other women, who maybe aren't even as good as you but are more attractive than you. And I think that starts to send a message to, you know, female athletes and to girls and everything, that it's, again, not so much about how good you are, but how good you look. And it reinforces this message at the same time we're having some of these, you know, women athlete service spokespeople saying, you can do it. It's about, you know, trying really hard and being your best. But at the same time, they're not quite sending that message. Because if you're, you know, number 15 and you're making more than who's number 4 because you look better, I think that sends a message that contradicts what we're trying to tell them and teach them.
Exactly. And so this is where I think that even at the intersection of gender and sports, my continuing concern, and this is something I've been in conversation with a colleague of mine who is a specialist of gender and sports working in Japan. And she is really concerned with the way that physical education is being taught, whereby even though you want to produce elite athletes who are, you know, world class in what they do, that they actually are still suffering from sexual harassment, sexual violence, even within the sports world. And so given the fact that there seems to be this contradiction whereby these women are, you know, achieving so much at these high levels, that the fact that they have still internalized this message of, you know, I need to listen to, you know, the man if he's telling me, you know, or touching me inappropriately, this is an ongoing concern. And so that's why we've started this conversation of how we can, you know, change, you know, ideas of body and the self-defense and implement that into even public education or basically a long-term kind of cultural transformation process, which is something I think we need to see.
And I think what you're talking about, both of you, is mixed messages. That someone can be a great athlete and yet they look around, they're told, oh, women can do anything, and yet all the coaches are men. And I've seen this, the same thing with these young girls who are, if they're in the Olympics or the world level, but they're still 15, 16, 17 years old. So they're young girls and they're often surrounded by men in positions of power and authority who have control over much of their life. And on top of that, girls are told, well, don't be too masculine. You may be an athlete, but, you know, you should look feminine. And I remember when I was a girl being told that we should wear dresses to judo tournaments because we're only recently been allowed to be here by the men and that we should be nice and not cause trouble. And I think that often, unfortunately, feeds into the susceptibility for sexual abuse. Like, I was at a judo tournament and there was a referee. And I'll tell you his name, Fletcher Thornton. You can look it up. He was in the New York Times for molesting and drugging underage female athletes. And there'd been complaints about him for years. And I was a teenager. He put his hand on me and I was 106 pounds. I looked at him and I said, you take your hand off me, I'll break your fucking arm. But, you know, nice girls don't talk like that. So we have these mixed messages to girls. You're an athlete, but, oh, you have to be nice and you have to get along with the boys and you have to get along with the men and you don't want to cause too much trouble. You don't want to be like Anne Marie over there with her big arms and her bad mouth. But you know what? It's pretty awesome being Anne Maria. So there.
Hey, Jonah, you know what I love? Seven Generation Games.
I know. They're the best. I got them for all my nieces and nephews. They teach math and social studies. They love the games.
I wanted to get them for my niece in third grade, but she only has an iPad. I just wish they had an app.
But they do.
What?
Yes, Making Camp. It's the first app from Seven Generation Games, and it's coming out in the Apple App Store in October.
So it will just be in the App Store?
Yes. All you'll have to do is search for Making Camp. Or you can go to the Seven Generation Games site right now and enter your email to be notified as soon as the app is live.
Wow, that's awesome. And they will still sell the other games too, right?
Yep, you can still get Spirit Lake, Fish Lake, and Forgotten Trail just by going to 7generationgames.com/buy to get them today.
This is Kevin Parker from Royer Labs. You can find more information about us at www.royerlabs.com, and you're listening to More Than Ordinary.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne Maria DeMars. And still here with us is our guest,
Setsu Shigematsu.
So now we're going to get into the part where we talk about, we don't say tips, but advice or perspective or things we wish we had known. And Anne Maria, obviously you are always full of things that you wish everybody had known. So why don't you kick us off?
Well, Setsu and I were talking about, you know, living in Japan. I was over there for my junior year of college. And I would talk to these women at Waseda University, which is a great university, really smart young women. And we'd be having conversations about some book that we had read or the difference between the U.S. and Japan. And then some guy who was one of my, you know, teammates on the judo team at Waseda would come by. And it was like they dropped 40 IQ points. They would be giggling behind their hand and acting stupid. I'm like, what's wrong with you? You're a really smart woman. And that's my tip, is don't make yourself less to make somebody else feel more. I see so many women, whether they're in sports or academia or business, and maybe they do this subconsciously. When there's a man around, they will act as if they don't know as much or they won't stand up for themselves. And I ask them why. Well, you know, he doesn't like it when I speak out, or let him be the one that takes credit. And I think, why? What about you? And, you know, it's like I was saying before when we were talking that you see these women, they could be a fourth degree black belt. They've won 3 national championships. And some guy who's a brown belt is saying, well, this is how you do.
It's called mansplaining.
And you don't have to put up with that. I mean, it's one thing. I you don't want to be an arrogant jerk. You know, maybe Bob or Roberta, for that matter, knows something that you don't know. So that's cool. But if somebody's coming up and talking down to you and telling you things that you already know, you don't need to pretend like you don't know. You don't need to not be the one that stands at the front of the line, you know, when people line up by rank because, oh, I don't want him to feel worse. Or in any of those thousands of ways that women make themselves smaller to make some man look bigger. I'm going to tell you what my husband says. My husband's a really good man, and we've been married 19 years. And when people say to him, well, your wife makes all this money and she goes to all these things and she's written a book and she's president this, that, I would feel like less. Don't you ever feel like less of a man if your wife's accomplishing all these things? And my husband said, if I ever wanted to know if I was a man, I would take my pants off and look down.
That's a great way of putting it. Thanks. What you're kind of getting at, though, is this, I think, internalized messaging that little girls get from the youngest age about, you know, how they look, which all feeds into this dominant narrative that we're still reproducing, I think, ad nauseum, the kind of heterosexual romance fantasy, which, you know, I also grew up with. And I just look back on my life to date, and I do think that I, you know, did waste a lot of energy trying to, you know, align myself with that value system. And it's hard to get out of it, you know, that whole beauty myth type of complex that women carry with them, which you were touching on earlier about, you know, which are the athletes get paid more because they look a certain way, even though they're not top in their field. And so for me, that's one of the other messages that I want to provide an alternative to in the Guardian Princess stories, is to get away from that heterosexual romance fantasy that, you know, basically, unless you appeal to men as a young girl or as a woman, just getting away from that paradigm altogether in terms of what is the ultimate purpose of your being on this earth. And, you know, who are you supposed to be appealing to in terms of your actions? Is it, you know, just finding that, you know, Prince Charming, so to speak, which, you know, I don't think any of us really believe in, but that seems to be still motivating a lot of the media, a lot of this type of story messaging that's out there. So that's where I also felt like I wanted to provide that kind of alternative to that dominant story.
Well, and also, it isn't saying that you won't appeal to men if you are a certain way. So I'm all about appealing to men. It's just, first of all, it doesn't have to be the be-all and end-all of your life. And secondly, there are certain types of men. Like my grandmother used to always say, you know, who's ever going to marry you with a pile of sweaty judo gis laid all around your house? And I think that the person who their biggest attribute they value in a person isn't their housekeeping. You know, I remember my late husband, when we were engaged, my judo coach says to him, I can't believe you're going to marry her. You know, she's like Murphy Brown. You know, she can't cook, won't clean, and her last boyfriend's buried under the steps. And Ron said to him, you know, Jimmy, if you're any kind of man, you'd go out there and get a job and hire somebody, and your wife wouldn't have to be cleaning floors. So it's not just about, oh, finding a man, but you know what? If you, like I said, if you have to make yourself less for him, find somebody who's big enough for you.
Well, and I think it's also about shifting the message. So, you know, we were talking, both of us have eight-year-olds, you know, and it's shifting the messages that they see. So, you know, not just in media, because I think a lot of it comes to them through media, but also in their own households and seeing in their family dynamics, you know, this idea that, yes, my husband does the dishes and all of these kind of things. And then also that message to them that you can do all of these things. I mean, my eight-year-old wants to be a programmer, and it has never for one second come into her mind that that's not within her realm of capabilities, or that people won't think that that's attractive or whatever. I mean, to her, we emphasize, you know, the smarter you are, the better. You know, I mean, not don't be better. Don't act like you're so much smarter than everyone else. But, you know, if you know the answer in math class, don't listen to this kid who says that you're wrong and he knows it. And we had an example of that earlier this year. And she's like, yeah, well, we're working in groups and he said it was this and I thought it was this, but I just went along with it. And it wasn't necessarily because he was a boy, but it was just because she went along with it and she was right and he was wrong. And she's like, I'm never doing that again. And we're emphasizing, yes, exactly. If you think you are right, say that you're right. You know, if you think you know the right answer, don't ever let anyone dissuade you from that. And so it's shifting that dynamic and that narrative of what kids are told on a daily basis. And I think what they hear in the media obviously has a lot of impact on them, but also if they're at home being told and reinforced, you're just as good and you should do this and you can be whatever you want to be and you can be the president, you can do whatever you want, that's going to shape them just as much as a lot of the other, you know, messages that they're getting.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.